and welcome to They Came From the North, your maple-drenched, woolly-toqued movie podcast from, what shall I say this time, the land of Labrador Retrievers and Lorne Green, Canada. I am Andrew Forbes. I will be your host for this evening. Joining me, as always, from the wind-battered and deep-fried shores of Craggy Island, a.k.a. Newfoundland, are Steve Deflower Power.
Deflower Power? Yes, that's correct. According to Canadian statistics...
You're like the anti-Guy Lafleur.
According to Canadian statistics, Newfoundlanders have more sex than anyone else in Canada.
Yeah, that's because you only just got an Orange Julius. All right, and also, by his side somewhat, a little bit away, maybe a snowball's throw away, is John Mercer. Do you want a nickname too?
Yeah.
How about John Shono Mercer?
I like it.
That's awesome. That's fantastic. You got
to
say.
I tried to work in something about tight jeans, but it just didn't work. All right, Gabriel Girard, our Quebec compatriot, won't be joining us this evening since, you know, being from Quebec, he feels the need to separate every so often. So.
No, man. He just knew what we'd be talking about in the ugly. And
he calls it going sovereign.
Going sovereign.
Sovereign is assuming command.
That's right. And this episode is episode 21. So we're finally men.
Hooray!
Something.
We can drink legally in Texas.
It is a legal drinking age. This party just became unacceptable.
We're sensible. Anyway, on this evening's episode, we will be chowing down on the tasty, tasty human remains of Richard Fleischer, director of such films as 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, Soylent Green, and Tora, Tora, Tora. So I'm just going to do a little bit of a bio on Fleischer first.
I really like how you caught him off there in the 70s.
That was maybe deliberate. Where was I? Birth, of course. December 8th, 1916, Brooklyn. Richard Fleischer was born to a rather venerable father, Max Fleischer, who was the pioneering animator who created those classic Superman cartoons in the 1940s. And interesting bit of trivia, he is at least credited by someone as the inventor of rotoscoping. So we have him to thank for a lot of Ralph Bakshi's career.
You son of a bitch!
Do the Superman cartoons counterbalance that? I don't know. His career began in, this is the younger Fleischer's career began in 1942 at RKO. He directed a number of short films and documentaries, even winning an Academy Award in 47 for producing Design for Death, a feature documentary co-authored by Dr. Seuss, of all people, about Japan's imperial culture and its significance to the Second World War. Fleischer's feature directing debut was the mostly forgotten 1946 domestic drama Child of Divorce, certainly a forbidding tale of what could go wrong if mommy and daddy don't get along, I guess, followed by Banjo in 1947, a comedy. So this is New York in 48. These aren't really held up as classics by much of anyone as far as I know, but also in 48, he did a film called Bodyguard, and that sort of kicked off a series of films where Fleischer really found his niche in hard-boiled crime stories and film noir. He would make five more. I don't know if they're all strictly speaking film noir, but they're all sort of that style of late 40s, early 50s crime film. One of which not including the Robert Mitchum James Russell thriller His Kind of Woman, which Fleischer was uncredited for. He did extensive reshoots at the behest of producer Howard Hughes, who was dissatisfied with the original director John Farrow's work on that. But probably the best known film from this period would be 1952's The Narrow Margin. He found a perfect leading man in Charles McGraw, who's sort of underappreciated these days. He's kind of that epitome of 50s tough guy, granite features, gravel voice, and Fleischer put together a really taut production. McGraw had a great presence in the movie, and the movie was a critical hit and even earned an Oscar nomination for Best Story. Later in the 50s, saw Fleischer helming a string of big-budget productions, most notably 1954's Disney epic 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea and 1958's The Vikings. Fleischer was a dependable hand at this kind of studio-driven feature, choosing to serve the story above all rather than injecting really much of any personal style or a strong personal stamp on the material. So he's quite popular with studio heads. He continued to do this kind of dependable studio work throughout the 1960s on films like Dr. Dolittle and Fantastic Voyage. In 1968, Fleischer, I don't know, it probably wasn't his first run-in with some controversy, but he helmed The Boston Strangler, and it was received sort of both positively and negatively. It got a couple of high-profile award nominations, but it was also panned by a number of prominent critics for essentially exploiting the public recognition of the real tragedy in service of a at least somewhat fictionalized account of a suspect who wasn't even confirmed to have committed the crimes. The 70s saw Fleischer starting off with a big, big budget international production, Tora, 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 which chronicles the bombing of Pearl Harbor and was helmed by both American and Japanese filmmakers. Fleischer handled the American side of the story, while Kinji Fukasaku and Toshio Masuda filmed the Japanese sequences. The film's bloated budget worked against it at the box office, although it did turn a profit, but critical response was mixed, chief complaints being that the film was essentially dull and uninvolving for such a big special effects heavy blockbuster. The rest of the 70s was rather mixed for Fleischer. He directed a couple of hugely influential movies like Soylent Green and the massively controversial Mandingo, which praised and panned in roughly equal measure, but at least gave us a great gag in Kentucky Fried Movie. But, you know, these sort of high-profile pictures were somewhat counterbalanced, at least in retrospect, by forgotten films like 10 Rillington Place. Anybody ever heard of it? Nope. The Incredible Sarah and Ashanti. In 1980, Fleischer directed the second remake of The Jazz Singer, with Neil Diamond in the title role of a junior cantor and Laurence Olivier as Diamond's repressive traditional Jewish father. The film was a huge critical failure, with Roger Ebert writing that the film had, quote, so many things wrong with it that a review threatens to become a list. The film is often included on lists of famous bombs, despite its $27 million gross. Diamond earned a Golden Globe nomination for Best Actor, but that accomplishment was probably tarnished somewhat by his being crowned the very first worst actor of the Razzie Awards. Fleischer's next film, 1983's Tough Enough, was dismissed by many as an opportunistic Rocky knockoff. He went on to direct a string of mostly reviled sequels, Amityville 3D, also in 1983, Conan the Destroyer in 1984, and the sort of pseudo-sequel in 1985, Red Sonja, which is also based on a Robert E. Howard property and also stars Arnold Schwarzenegger, although he does not play Conan.
Let's face it, he plays Conan.
And also, I don't think Red Sonja was actually a Howard creation. I think she came along in the Marvel comics.
Oh, is that okay? There was some mention of Robert E. Howard and some kind of tie-in, but
the name comes from Howard. The character comes from the character comes from Roy Thomas.
Yeah,
Mercer, you're screwing up. When I'm getting to Million Mystery.
That's very.
Oh, that's my absolute favorite Fleischer film.
Well, I'm sorry to say, unfortunately, that it was another strong contender at the Razzie Awards, which marked a rather sad end to an impressive career. But Fleischer did live long enough to enjoy his retirement. He wrote a memoir in 1993, the well-received Just Tell Me When to Cry, which chronicled his many, many problems with producers and actors, and I haven't read it, but by all accounts, it's at least somewhat juicy. Richard Fleischer passed away in 2006 at the age of 89, and that's where his career ends for good. So without further ado, let's get down to business of the good, the bad, and the so very ugly of director Richard Fleischer. Let's start with Steve.
Oh.
Flower us all with your insight.
I had a few that I wanted to pick. I figure you guys will probably go for the narrow margin. So I'm going to leave that one alone. Suffice it to say that it's definitely, you know, like it epitomizes film noir as a genre for sure. And I mean, it's a great, strong, strong movie. But I actually have to go with 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
Interesting.
You know, for a film from 1954? It still looks great. It still plays pretty well. The effects work is still top notch. And it really is a great adaptation of, you know, a real classic science fiction story. I think Fleischer just directed the hell out of it. There's some great sequences in there, like the squid attack, of course. Great performances from Douglas and, you know, well, Peter Lorre is Peter Lorre, but you know.
Peter Lorre playing a professor who looks 5 years younger than him.
And James Mason was, I thought he was great as Captain Nemo, you know.
Owns like, the screen as Captain Nemo.
He does, man, he does. It was just overall, I found it was a movie that really came together well. And I have to give mad props to the production design. Like that production design was, I mean, when that movie was released, we hadn't seen anything like that.
Tell you the truth, I remember the first time I ever saw 20,000 Leagues of the Sea was on the old Disney Family Channel in the late 80s. And that's probably the first time I can remember being blown away by the sets in a film.
Yeah.
The dinner sequence inside the Nautilus when they're the big, huge pipe organ in the background and everything.
Yeah.
It's mind-blowing stuff.
Now, was this Pan and Scan when you saw it?
Oh, quite possibly. It was on television.
Yeah, yep. I mean, I saw it originally in
widescreen.
Oh, it's totally a CinemaScope movie.
Gorgeous.
I think I'm used to seeing it, you know, from old VHS rentals or probably even beta rentals, actually. And they used to show it a lot on Saturday afternoons on CBC. You always used to see it. You know, it was in steady rotation. So, I mean, I kind of grew up with the movie.
First they show you 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, and then for some goddamn reason they put the black hole on afterwards.
Or Herbie Rides Again.
Talking black hole.
Or on the night when they decide to give John Mercer nightmares, he put on Something Wicked This Way Comes.
Or the Boogity Man.
The Boogity Man. I digress.
20,000 Leagues Under the Sea until I picked up the DVD to prepare for this podcast. You know, I'm not going to say I didn't love it, but it was, I mean, it's undeniably a impressively mounted production. I found it dragged in a couple of spots and some of the characters irritated me a bit, but I mean, they're kind of minor complaints that I have. And really it's just this fantastic looking, like big, big, big production, the kind of which, you know, I mean, it's not like we don't get huge movies anymore, obviously. Something about, you know, seeing those big models and volcano layers and things actually physically built that feels quite different. So
we still see a big movie, but they don't, like to use the tired cliche, they don't make them like that anymore.
It also features Kirk Douglas, you know, singing a sea shanty. He apparently only knows one song in this movie. Repeatedly.
He just sings It's a Whale of a Tale. Over and over. I don't know. Like for me, it was, I guess part of it is where I grew up with it and stuff. I can definitely see that there are one or two flaws, and I think that's really brought on by the episodic nature of it. You know, like how it does kind of unfold in little vignettes, I guess, you know?
No doubt, even watching it, coming to it new, like I can see how, and I don't want to say this as like a slight or a bad compliment to the movie, but I can see how it would be play extremely well when nostalgia came into play.
Yeah, for sure. And also like to see it as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
You know? It's kind of like Treasure Island that way. It's like Disney's Treasure Island. It's the kind of movie that, you know, they feel to an adult to sit down and watch it for the first time. You can tell that it's of another era, but for a child to sit down and watch it, like it still works. It can still play.
It's funny that you brought up Treasure Island because I mean Treasure Island. That's where we get that stereotypical pirate speak.
Yeah, and yeah.
Under the Sea is almost, I don't want to say it's like the birth of steampunk, but it's a lot of those elements kind of come into play in some of those retro futuristic aesthetics that we see a lot in modern popular culture.
Oh, I totally think it is to steampunk what Blade Runner is to cyberpunk. I really do.
It is very cool. And I think James Mason was probably, when he's playing that organ, he's like working out for his big performance as a cortisone-addled father in Bigger Than, what is it? Oh, that movie. Anyway. Bigger Than Life?
I don't remember.
But whatever.
I know his beard was just magnificent.
He convinces, as a seagoing fellow, as someone who grew up with an oceanographer father, I can confirm that indeed the beard is accurate. All right, well, John, how about you? What's your good for Richard Fleischer?
I'll tell you, I honestly, I didn't go with the narrow margin. I'm going to hope you pick the narrow margin, actually, because we can't all pass it off.
No.
But, I mean, that's just – it's a great movie. I had to go with something a little bit – this is a personal favorite of mine, despite having heard several times people told me it's a terrible, terrible movie. Another Kirk Douglas Fleischer film, one called The Vikings.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Just – you know, the forerunner to such – films as Gladiator. Just a big, bold, colorful, bloody
and mean.
Mean history.
Like, that's the thing that struck me when I first watched it is like, you know, I was getting ready for a somewhat neutered 50s historical epic and man.
Oh, great. Ernest Borgnine. Oh my God, Borgnine's a bastard.
Doesn't it basically start with Ernest Borgnine raping someone?
Yes, it does.
If your movie starts with Ernest Borgnine raping somebody, you know, what more do you want?
And then you got Kirk Douglas with that badass scar across his eye.
Gets his eye taken out by a falcon.
Yeah. That's manly, right? And that's why I love so much about the Vikings. It's just, the movie is pure testosterone. Right.
I also have to add about the Viking. The final sequence of that movie, like the post sword fight sequence, is one of the most gorgeously filmed scenes I've ever seen.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good movie to show when the thing with Richard Fleischer is he doesn't have a distinctive style, really.
No.
Like he knew what a movie needed when he was preparing it and filming it. And it's not like he didn't have the chops. He just didn't put his own style ahead of what the story demanded. And, like, The Vikings is a perfect example of that. It's just gorgeous.
Yeah, well, I mean, it feels like just about every other of those, like, those real overproduced, like, historical stage dramas of that era, like stuff like The Robe.
The latest Cecil B. DeMille epic.
Yeah, you know, like stuff like The Robe or The Ten Commandments. Like, it's got that DNA, but it feels different. It feels, I think it's part of it. It's mean.
It's not hopeful or cheerful. It's Sergio Leone 10 years prior to Sergio Leone.
Yeah.
It spawned this really sort of great, sort of terrible Mario Bava kind of ripoff. Called Eric, I think it was
Eric the Conqueror, was it, or something like that?
It's an Eric the Viking, but that's
the Viking.
The other one, but yeah, Eric the Conqueror, which is, you know, again, it's sort of like Mario Bava doing his, like, I have 1/10 of the budget.
I remember really digging Eric the Conqueror, but I haven't seen it in probably about 20 years.
It's like, it's got like some pretty sweet like miniature work and some inventive little special effects. But man, the Vikings is just, there's no copying it. It's just brutal, and that sort of it's an old sort of trite kind of story, you know, two brothers, one of whom is illegitimate and this and that. And that sword fight is so awesome.
Oh, the one at the end?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, it is.
Amazing.
Cool, really cool sequence for it too. Like it's set. It's not what you see typically for a sword fight. You know, it's kind of a precarious location to start swinging steel at each other.
Yeah.
And, okay, has the statute of limitations passed on the Vikings?
Sure.
Yeah.
First time I ever saw in a movie the now cliche stabbing someone with a broken sword.
Yeah.
Right? And it's just, it's awesome when it happens.
And there's one more thing I want to say about the Vikings, because I feel I have to pick something else as my good. There's this great scene, in the Mead Hall where there's a competition involved. There's some question of infidelity, I think. And
are we talking about axe dancing?
Yeah. Throwing axes at this woman who's like tied to an upturned table and cutting her pigtails, which is just like super tense, but simultaneously hilarious because Kirk Douglas is just like laughing his ass off and being horrible. it is amazing.
It's a pretty awesome flick. The only big downside for
get off of her, Anna. I have read all the classics.
My only real problem with the Vikings is... my problem with it is the production design. Like, it doesn't look particularly Norse to me, you know?
Where'd they film it? Like, Wales, I think?
Probably.
If you're willing to, you know, accept that it's the Hollywood sort of sensationalized, romanticized version, I'm okay with it.
No, wait a second. It was actually filmed in Norway.
Although
Aelis Castle was in Brittany, northeast Brittany.
Don't they make some kind of joke about Kirk Douglas having shaved his face and having a face like a woman? He's so vain, he doesn't want his face covered with a beard, which was probably just Kirk Douglas being like, fuck, I'm not growing a beard.
Kirk Douglas going, I can't grow a beard.
Probably. He could probably just grow a beard out of that, like, chin dimple.
Well, it's not, that's the problem, is just every bit of hair he grows is just sucked into it. His beard crosses his dimples event horizon, is just folded in.
Black pit, and it just devours any facial hair that starts to grow, digesting it slowly over 1,000 years.
Ew. What about you, Andrew? What have you got?
Man, I found this really tough. I feel like I gave The Narrow Margin a bit of a shout out in my intro. Everybody should go see The Narrow Margin. It is a great, great movie. But for my good, I really want to pick Soylent Green. Because
that's a magnificent ascot Heston wears.
I think a lot of people, you know, they've heard the big twist and they kind of assume they don't have to see it. And the movie is so much more than that twist. It's, you know, this great sort of, not exactly a social commentary, although I think, you know, people were definitely feeling the squeeze, certainly in, you know, parts of New York. And there was a sense that overpopulation was going to become this big problem. But it is just this very cool kind of speculative story about, you know, what's going to happen when we don't have the resources and all these people are crammed in, and, you know, how are people going to see life? There's an absolutely heartbreaking scene about two-thirds into the movie, maybe three-quarters into the movie, where, spoiler alert, Edward G. Robinson's character, Saul Roth, decides that, you know, after he learns this great, horrible secret about Soylent Green, decides, you know, he's had it, he doesn't want to live anymore, and he goes to this retirement facility, which is where people can go if they don't want to live anymore. You know, overpopulation is such a problem that they're willing to help people along their exit from humanity. So, you know, he goes into this and he's basically, you know, prepared on this bed and pampered. And then there's this amazing, you know, huge widescreen display right over him as, I can't remember what's playing. It's like the Rites of Spring or something, but fantastic choice of music. And all of these scenes of nature, you know, go by and you just get the sense that, you know, this is a world that either, you know, no one there has seen or he only remembers from sort of the most remote period in his life. And Charlton Heston sort of bursts in and they have a bit of a last fantastic scene. And probably an example of craftsmanship sort of at its best. So, yeah, it's a movie that deserves to be known for more than a certain line yelled out in Charlton Hestonese.
Yeah, it's definitely one of the betters of the pre-Star Wars 70s sci-fi that it gets kind of unfairly shoehorned in with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like it's a better movie than The Omega Man.
I was just about to say it always gets lumped in with The Omega Man.
The Omega Man and Silent Running and, right?
What was that, the one about the big tank?
Oh, Desolation Alley.
Yeah, or Devastation Alley or something like that?
No, it's Desolation Alley.
Oh, okay.
Oh, no, Damnation Alley.
Damnation Alley.
Damnation Alley, sorry. Yeah. I was thinking about the song Desolation Row just then. No, Damnation Alley with the Landmaster.
Yeah.
The Landmaster was badass. The giant mutant scorpions were not.
Blue screen scorpions.
I always liked Soylent Green. Like it was a movie that, you know, I hadn't seen for a long time, mainly because of the whole, you know, the extremely obvious plot twist. And I think when I finally did watch it, it was like late night on Space. It was just something they showed on the Space Network, and which is Canada's equivalent to Sci-Fi for all our American listeners. But and I was really, you know, I was very pleasantly surprised. I thought they handled dystopia rather well.
Okay. I'm not going to say it's an equal to it as at all, because it's not, because the movie I'm about to compare it to is the greatest science fiction film ever made. But it plays out the same way as Blade Runner.
Hmm.
You know, it's Blade Runner is not a movie about robots. Blade Runner is a detective story. Soylent Green is, you know, a police procedural, right?
Exactly.
It's a cop movie that just happens to be set in a world gone to shit.
Yeah. And, I mean, and with a really rather, I mean, Charlton Heston's kind of a shitty character in the movie. Especially, you know, he goes into this crime scene where someone's been murdered. He's going to this guy's apartment that's, like, big wealthy guy. And he's basically just, like, pocketing everything he wants. Because he's like, well, I'm a detective. I'm just going to take whatever because this guy's dead now. So,
is that when he starts spooning the jam into his mouth?
I think so. And then
cops in the future were so corrupt.
How do you afford that scarf, Heston?
Yeah, awesome, awesome movie. Better than most of that sort of era's kind of dull, boring, unimaginative sci-fi stuff, and really, really great opening titles, which
really
I believe
great.
Find on Art of the Title, which is a great website that everyone should go to. But yeah, fantastic titles that basically just tell.
Hey, if I can stand Edward G. Robinson in it, it's a good movie.
How can you not stand? What? Hang on, stand Edward G. Robinson?
Meh.
No. That was movie.
Can we call you Little Caesar? Sure.
He did that in one movie, and that was terrible. And everything else he's been in, he's been amazing.
Oh, that's all he's remembered for, though.
I saw him in one movie that was really good, and I don't remember what it was.
It's kind of like Jason Biggs will always be the pie fucker. Edward G. Robinson will always be meh.
How about Double Indemnity?
Yes, that was what I saw him in, was Double Indemnity. He was fantastic in Double Indemnity.
Don't mess with Robinson. All right. Well, we've talked about our good. And before I get further and further into Little Caesar, let's talk about our bad, which for those of you who don't know, our bad isn't necessarily bad in the traditional sense. It's a movie that, you know, we like, but is hampered significantly by some problems. Or maybe we don't like, but has some pretty good things going for it as well. So I guess I'll go in the same order. Steve, what's your bad?
Man, this one was a little tougher for me than my good.
But yeah, Fleischer kind of, there's no middle ground. It's either awesome or awful.
I wouldn't even go that far, but I just, every fiber of my being wants to pick Conan the Barbarian, or Conan the Destroyer, sorry. I just can't. I think I would have to go with the Vikings.
Oh.
And it's not
Conan the Destroyer is right there with Tracy Walters.
Well, and this is the other thing. Like, this is one of my deep, dark secrets. I don't hate Conan the Destroyer. I don't particularly like it, but I don't hate it. You know what I mean?
I kind of get what you're saying.
As far as a simple, you know, swords and sorcery movie goes, the biggest crime it's guilty of is not being Conan the Barbarian.
It's not even Deathstalker.
No, it's better than Deathstalker. Don't go there.
No, it's better than Deathstalker 2. It's not better than Deathstalker 1.
I'll have my revenge in Deathstalker 2.
It has Grace Jones. It has Tracy Walter.
Okay, speaking of great opening titles, Deathstalker 2.
Okay, it just became Conan the Destroyer, I think. I can't talk about the Vikings anymore.
I ripped out by a falcon.
He does. And the Vikings, I love the Vikings, but I just... To me, it's the era colors the movie too much for me. You know, like it just doesn't feel like a Viking picture. It just feels like, you know, another stage drama. And I think that's my biggest problem with it. The ending notwithstanding, because that ending is absolutely glorious.
Well, but, fair enough.
I'll leave the Vikings alone. I'll pick on Conan the Destroyer some more. Conan the Destroyer, man, like, the character is there, and I was a kid who read a lot of the Marvel comics, a lot of the Conan the Barbarian comic books. I loved the Marvel Conan, and I understand what they were trying to do with the movie. You know, they had found out that the majority of the box office dollars that came from Conan the Barbarian were from people who were underage who shouldn't have been watching it. So when they made the sequel, they thought, hey, if we cater to this crowd, maybe we'll get all the fans from the first movie and these other guys besides. And
hey, let's change the tone completely.
Yeah. But, and you know,
they made the first movie great. Blood, swords, titties.
There was still blood in the second one. There were still swords in the second one.
No, the first one didn't have enough NBA players.
Yeah, that's right. And what's hilarious is he was probably
or Andre the Giant.
Chamberlain was probably the best part of the second movie.
He was definitely
sure as hell wasn't Grace Jones.
I can't really say anything against Will Chamberlain in this movie, especially, you know, when there's stuff like Carlo Rambaldi's abominations.
Yeah, yeah.
Like E.T., these are not.
But it's just for all of its flaws, for all of its, you know, badness, and it is a bad movie. I mean, let's just call a spade. It's a horrible movie, but it has moments that are extremely well shot. It has some action sequences that are really well done. That opening sequence with the guys on horseback, Arnold taking
and the net.
Yeah, it was awesome. Yeah, that was a great opening, man.
great score to that movie too.
And the and Palladoras, I mean, he came back and he knocked out another great score. You know, like he kind of took the one from the first one and sped up the tempo a little bit to match the movie and that kind of stuff. And it, you know, it was a
made it a little more heroic sounding.
Yeah,
rather than just the, I mean, the first one, Anvil of Crom is epic.
Yeah,
right.
And but, on top of that, you know. It moved like stink. It was a really fast moving movie. It was, you know, it was just a, you know, an adventure road picture.
Mm-hmm.
It's not something, you know, I'm not going to break it out constantly. I mean, 9 times out of 10, if I want to watch a Conan movie, I'm going to watch Conan the Barbarian. But, and the other time I'll probably watch the remake. But, but every now and again, the mood hits me and I do, you know, pop Conan the Destroyer off the shelf and I will pop it in and have a little bit of fun with it. You know, it's not like you watch it ironically, you enjoy it for what it is, which is a decent little swords and sorcery adventure flick from the 80s. You know, it's not the pariah that it's made out to be. It's not Red Sonja.
Oh, Red Sonja. No.
I'd like to take a moment to apologize to the family of Carlo Rambaldi, who I just found out died in August.
Well, you didn't say anything terrible. You weren't like, you know, after seeing Carlo Rambaldi's abominations in Conan the Destroyer, I wish he was dead.
Oh,
I didn't say it on record, certainly. yeah, Conan the Destroyer is I definitely know what you mean, Steve. Like, and especially, you know, there are kinds of movies that I like, and if there's a sort of weak one that still has those elements that I love.
Exactly, exactly.
I tend to enjoy it, so, and I can do that for Conan to some degree. I mean, there are some pretty cool sequences, too.
And I mean, as far as loyalty to the character and stuff like that, neither of the movies is loyal to the character, so I mean, you know, that's not really something you can complain about. And if you're looking at loyalty...
Milius was trying, he was basically in the business of myth-making.
Yeah.
It's Conan the Barbarian, and Conan the Destroyer is so much less than that.
Conan the Destroyer is an adaptation of the Marvel comic.
Yeah.
You know, and that's kind of what I like about it.
Well, I mean, yeah, there's all sorts of, like, little hints and everything there. You know, you got Pat Roach as Tothamon, who pretty much turns into Thak the Man-Ape.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And even though it's not deliberately said, though. I mean, he looks just like him. Right?
Oh, he
is. He's credited as Man-Ape / Tothamon. Yeah.
And the other side of it, too, is, I mean, it was written by Roy Thomas, who brought Conan to Marvel Comics in the 70s and actually ran Conan and Savage Sword of Conan right up into the 90s, I believe. So, you know, he was a big fan, and he tried to kind of put his own personal touch on it. Whether he succeeded or failed, I mean, we all know that the Milius movie is still very fondly remembered, but Conan the Destroyer is not so much. So, you know, whether he succeeded or failed, we pretty much know the answer to that question.
Hey, and props to Sven Ole Thorsen for apparently surviving the first movie.
Yeah, yeah.
And coming back.
I would have never thought it, man. I thought Conan killed the shit out of him in the first movie. That was a pretty definitive villain death right there.
You thought so, but apparently not. All right. We've done Steve's bad. So, John, we haven't done you yet, have we?
No, we have not.
The floor is yours. $1 million mystery.
No, $1 million mystery is $1 million mystery has no redeemable factors to it, right? There's that can't be a bad. I just got to think here for a second. Probably Mr. Majestic. Mm-hmm. I'm a big Elmore Leonard fan, right? And you know, when he's on, I can really enjoy Charles Bronson. And Mr. Majestic is one of the better Bronson pictures. It's kind of, I think it came out probably right before Death Wish.
Yeah, I think so. Death Wish was 75, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think.
Yeah, Majestic was 74.
And Majestic was kind of like Bronson was graduating out of the spaghetti westerns and out of the, like, you know, bruiser roles and everything. It was really, this was kind of his. Yeah, he was kind of dabbling with being a star at this point. You know, Majestic was kind of like, Mr. Majestic was like Jason Statham's The Transporter, right? It was kind of like Bronson's coming into his own.
But this was the Japanese cologne commercial period of Bronson's career, I believe.
And but that, I mean, that being said, there's just Majestic has aged terribly. You know, it's very, very much a 1970s movie.
Like, you don't get enough movies about melon farmers anymore.
No, you don't. You'd never see, and let alone an action movie about a melon farmer. But I mean, it's, I don't know. There's just there's things about it I like. You know, it's a pretty tight little movie. It's action sequences are fairly decent. You know, Bronson could be a bit of a brute when he wanted to be, and he was kind of the middle ground before he started looking too old to be taken seriously as a threat.
Mm-hmm. I think he was into his 50s when he did this, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was. But I mean, he looked like Majestic looked like, you know, muscle wrapped in leather, right?
Yeah.
Bronson
was ripped right into the 80s.
But he, it just, I don't know, man, just, it's aged terribly. And there's a lot of the, I find a lot of the, when it tries to be socially aware, it's kind of like cramming it down your throat.
Yeah.
You know, with like the all the stuff about the corrupt union workers and the poor Mexican migrant workers that he wants to hire and.
Mm-hmm. Right? If only he could just pay these poor migrant workers less than minimum wage.
Yeah, I know the mob doesn't want that. But what's Charles Bronson going to do? Shoot people. Shoot a whole lot of people.
And it's got our favorite anthropomorphic nostril. Al Letieri.
I honestly really have nothing to add on this movie. I've never seen it.
Oh, oh man. One of Quentin Tarantino's favorites.
Ooh.
I'm not sure.
Run right out. Am I?
Yeah, that's a ringing endorsement if I ever heard one.
Yeah.
Not only is he a melon farmer, he's a former U.S. Army Ranger and Vietnam War veteran.
Of course.
Who becomes a melon farmer because he just wants peace.
That was his dream, exactly. Man. Back in
He wants to be a pacifist. He doesn't want to hurt people anymore.
He was in the jungle, you know, waiting for blood up to his face.
Won't let him stop killing.
Fighting the Kong, and he just wanted to go home and grow some melons.
Oh, mercy.
Yeah, like, you try to describe it to someone, and it sounds like the worst, stupidest. Like, this movie sounds as bad as Billy Jack.
Well, when I heard the title Mr. Majestic, I just thought immediately that it was about Tom Selleck going to Japan to play baseball.
And now, okay, now imagine Drexel in True Romance, if that's what he was talking about.
No, I don't want to. You can't make me.
Yeah, so it's Majestic rises above what it should have ended up as. You know, it's got a decent screenplay by Leonard based on his little short novel. And Bronson was a pretty effective action hero at this point in his career, but you know, it's just it's very early 70s.
Yeah.
It's very, like, post-Dirty Harry.
Yeah. Post-Dirty Harry, but pre-Escape from New York.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, for my bad, I'm picking a movie that, honestly, before I watched it, I kind of thought that this was going to be my ugly, just based on what everyone says about it. I figured there's no chance, you know, it's going to be as terrible as people say. And I'm not endorsing this movie. I'm not telling anyone that they should go out and spend their hard-earned money trying to see this movie. But The Jazz Singer is not as bad as people say it is.
You lie!
It's not.
I have no son.
There are some really, really bad things about it. But it ended up being mediocre and not awful. The way I thought it would.
Passable entertainment.
I wouldn't go that far.
Okay, so in the same vein as Conan the Destroyer.
Yeah, except I've never had a thing about, you know, middle-aged men going out to make it on their own. I mean, this is a movie that, you know, I don't want to give people the wrong impression. This is a movie that decided the best way to play homage to the classic original was to actually have, in 1980, Neil Diamond appear in blackface.
Wow.
This is the movie where...
Ernie Hudson's reaction in that scene, though, is worth the price of the ticket.
Yeah. That ain't no brother. That's a white man. Yeah, there are enough sequins to, you know, blind a whole hospital wing full of cataract patients. There are some very shiny, shiny moments in it. Laurence Olivier is quite terrible. But Neil Diamond is not. Neil Diamond is actually perfectly serviceable. And actually, I'd go further. He's quite good in this movie.
We were talking about this last week. Everybody remembers Olivier, mm-hmm. like throwing his hands up in the air and screaming, "I have no son."
I have no son. That's not what happens at all.
No, it's not what happens at all.
It
makes me wish that's what happened.
Yeah, that was the biggest letdown of this movie. Actually, was I was looking forward to that, and I mean, certainly before that, there's a very sort of like awkward, sort of palsied tearing of clothing.
And you're like, man, Zeus is gonna fucking freak.
Here come the lightning bolts.
And then he does it.
Lightning bolts would be useless against those sequins. But yeah, Neil Diamond is actually, he's really relaxed and natural. He's basically playing a version of himself.
He's just playing Neil Diamond.
But, you know, I've seen far, far.
Actually, he's kind of playing Neil Diamond crossed with Bruce Springsteen.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I've seen far worse performances from allegedly sort of more professional actors. There are a couple of moments where, you know, some of the more heated moments, maybe it's a little stiff, but for the most part, he's, you know, one of the best parts of the movie. I'm not really a huge Neil Diamond fan. I like a couple of his songs, but mostly I find him just horribly uncool. And if you want to see his awkward stage moves, this is a good place to see them. He's actually almost less convincing as a singer than he is in his just performance during the, like, as a guy. Like, as soon as he goes up on stage, I'm like, I don't really buy this guy as a superstar, oddly enough. You know, he's got these hip movements that kind of looks like he's basically just trying to, like, fuck the audience in the face.
Oh!
While he's rocking his, like, fuchsia, reflective, crazy Casanova shirt. But yeah, I mean, the movie is super formulaic and there are no surprises in it. And it's thoroughly mediocre right down the line. It's not as bad as people say it is. It's not as satisfyingly awful as people say it is. I was kind of hoping for a terrible movie that I could laugh at, and I couldn't laugh at most of it.
It's proof positive that the Razzies are invented to just basically beat up on whatever movie happens to be Hollywood's whipping boy during the awards season.
And this is a movie that before it came out, it was hurt because Sidney J. Fury was the original director. And Laurence Olivier was like just hated working on this movie. And he was overheard allegedly at a restaurant by a journalist, you know, saying, "Oh, this movie's shit. It's going to be horrible." They ran with it. Olivier allegedly, you know, wrote a very apologetic letter to Richard Fleischer saying, you know, this was not about you and I'm sorry if I've hurt the movie. I think he maybe went a bit overboard and this sort of came back against it again, later, but, the movie was more of a sort of curiosity. It was very much in the way that everyone was waiting to see how Titanic was going to fail. And the movie just doesn't live up to that kind of hype, either positive or negative. So that's why it's my bad.
I think it's fair enough. I think it's a fair assumption.
Excellent. I'm not completely insane.
No, you're definitely not.
All right, on to the really exciting part. Our favorite. And, oh, what a buffet of choices there are. So I'm going to switch it up. John, what is your ugly for Richard Fleischer?
Part of me wants to say Red Sonja, but I think there's other people here who are going to pick Red Sonja, and it's going to be absolutely hilarious. So, let's... Million Dollar Mystery. What the hell? The man who directed The Vikings and 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea and The Narrow Margin and, you know, some epic, very important films... goes out on a promotional tie-in for Gladlock garbage bags.
That was the million-dollar mystery, though, John.
It's crazy.
For anyone who doesn't know, like the whole point, the movie was a treasure hunt. You know, it's basically kind of like it's a mad, mad, mad world, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or
without a plane flying through a billboard.
You know, and it's the whole movie ended. One of the garbage bags full of money hadn't been found, and teased the audiences in the theater that to find the last bag of money. The Million Dollar Mystery didn't even make $1 million in theater. It made $989,033, which the studio had to give because they'd promised $1 million.
Find their own bag.
So they had to give it to the contest winner who found it. I believe the money was, I'm just checking Wikipedia now, hidden in the bridge of the Statue of Liberty's nose.
Wow.
So, oh my God, I didn't even realize. This is the movie Dar Robinson died on.
It is, yeah.
That's horrible.
And the movie was dedicated to him.
Thankfully, they dedicated Lethal Weapon to him after that.
Hmm. Man, there's a lot of terrible movies that end up being dedicated to people who deserve better.
Street Fighter. Actually, no, I'm not even saying it. Street Fighter's magnificent.
No, it isn't.
But Million Dollar Mystery is just, it's not even one of those movies, like, it's not even a situation where you can say it's so 80s that I have to love it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't even enjoy this on an ironic level. It's just, it's absolutely terrible. And it's, you know, the fact that this is what Fleischer went out on.
Yeah.
He deserved better.
Terrible.
He
did. And I mean, not
crass, man. It's just,
exactly, crass.
Yeah.
Oh, just I always look forward to this part of the show, and then I get really sad.
The poster even has a big GLAAD logo on it.
Does it really?
Yes.
Wow.
Ironic. No one was glad with the way this movie turned out.
Well, on the plus side, it certainly was trash.
And those two jokes were better than anything in Million Dollar Mystery.
The only name I recognize in the cast list is Kevin Pollak.
And that's reason enough to stay away.
And there's a character named Awful Abdul.
Another reason to stay away. Thankfully, I've never seen it.
You should download it.
No, I shouldn't. I definitely should not.
All right. Well, Steve, regale us. What is your ugly choice?
My ugly choice. There really was only one option for me here.
Yes. Yes.
Yes.
We're talking about a revulsive, steaming pile of nonsensical, just slow-moving, meandering bullshit.
poop. It's made of poop.
Of course, I can only be talking about Tora, Tora, Tora. No, I mean, I'm what? No, that's wrong.
I was
no.
about to say that. Oh, my God.
No, it wasn't. I was actually, of course, referring to Red Sonja, which is just...
You mean Red Sonja?
Red Sonja? Where is Red Sonja? Gedrin? You mean Queen Gedrin? Come down here and I'll spank you. Oh.
Do it like Bridget Nielsen.
It's just, oh, it's such a horrible, horrible, horrible movie. It's the entire thing looks like it was filmed in fog. It's just dark and dreary looking. There's no life whatsoever to any of the action.
I think it's one of the worst cases of Schwarzenegger not trying.
And he's the best in it. He's the best part of it.
Yes, but he you can like.
I disagree. Pat Roach is the best part of it.
Like, it's impossible to divide by the number of fucks Schwarzenegger gave making this movie. Zero fucks.
It even managed to make Pat Roach and Ronald Lacey suck. You know? Man, how could you ruin...
Pat Roach was moderately cool. Unfortunately, he lasts about 4.5 minutes.
Yeah. Oh, it's
this movie was nothing but, like... I mean, the premise was weak, and then the movie was nothing but, like, just going off on tangents.
Yeah, it was just, let's go here. Okay, now let's go here. And wait, there's, like, a fight scene of some kind, but it's so small scale.
There are only 3 days left.
Did the green, like, Destroyer of Worlds thing even have a name in it?
I don't know.
Maybe. I think it was just called, like, the Talisman or something.
Let's pretend it didn't.
I can just remember, you know, you, myself, and Dobbin sitting down watching. I was like, turn it off. My balls ache. So
I think we got like 45 minutes in, and it was just like, we got to stop this movie right now. This must
I think
end.
I'm getting a brain hemorrhage.
The best part, the great thing, and I'm being sarcastic here, about this movie is how it starts with like, it basically gives 10 seconds for an entire backstory between the heroine and the villain. Involving her entire culture being destroyed and her family being murdered and the town being burned down and her being raped by all these soldiers. And it's like, wait, okay, that happened? Who again?
It's the exact same setup as Conan the Barbarian, only it's done in decidedly... Exactly. Yeah.
Because they didn't have the budget to show any of it. All they could show was a close-up on Bridget Nielsen on some grass going, eh!
And Sandal Bergman is not James Earl Jones.
No.
Sandal Bergman is awful in this movie. It makes me wonder if... I mean, she wasn't particularly good in Conan the Barbarian.
No.
But it makes me wonder... Like, I was watching this and I was like, hang on. Did she actually have any lines in Conan and the Barbarian? Because if she did, how could I have not noticed how awful she is?
Well, I mean...
Because they gave her awesome lines like, do you want to live forever?
And see, no, but when she says that I cringe. Every time that, like, you want to live forever? I always cringe. At that. You know?
Two fools who laugh at death. You don't even have a rope. That's what's that... And, oh my God, that is the exact point in Conan when Subutai stops being Mongolian and becomes a surfer. She walks on set and is so terrible, he just doesn't care anymore.
and I mean, Arnold playing Conan. Hello, my name is Calidor.
Calidor.
My name is Conan Elidor.
It's your costume.
He actually kind of, like...
L. Smith, a.k.a.
How long... Okay, Schwarzenegger's in, what, about probably about 15 minutes?
He's in a fair chunk of it. He's around for most of the movie.
I was
the poster for the movie gone, is all Schwarzenegger.
Yeah.
Ugh.
He is in a fair bit of it. He does like pretty much share the screen, you know.
And holy shit, did I ever want to murder Ernie Reyes Jr.
Oh my God. Oh.
I didn't want to murder him after Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2: Secret of the Ooze. I wanted to murder him after this.
Oh my God, it was terrible. He was, oh.
What about Surf Ninjas Must Die?
I fortunately never saw that one.
Nor me.
That was just you.
Oh, it's just...
In a small room, watching a terrible movie, crying.
A About the only good thing I can say about Red Sonja, if I have to say something good about it, the costume design wasn't too bad.
The whole production design actually is pretty good.
Yeah.
like the certainly and the palace at the end, that like throne room is hella cool. It's pretty darn cool.
It's pretty neat, but then you get like Sonja herself, whose sword looks really, really gay, and whose outfit looks kind of...
There goes our humanitas.
Sorry. Okay, let me rephrase that. Her sword looks really, really lame, and her outfit looks kind of...
Take that, people with limps.
It has a very retro style to it, I guess. You know, a very 1950s look.
It's, I'm just going to say, after watching Red Sonja, I no longer feel bad for Bridget Nielsen for being in a relationship with Flava Flav.
I wonder if Stallone ever calls Flavor Flav and asks him how he likes his sloppy seconds.
Hey, how do you like my Danish?
I love that both Arnold Schwarzenegger and Maria Shriver make fun of the movie as well. Schwarzenegger promises that when his children misbehave, he makes them watch Red Sonja over and over again. And Shriver, I believe, at the premiere said something along the lines of, well, if this doesn't kill your career, nothing will.
She then said, I'll get you, He-Man.
It was just, yeah. Oh.
I mean, we haven't even brought up... All right, who wrote this? Clive Ext. No, because it's like the worst type of bargain basement fantasy names on things.
I believe
Clive Exton wrote like Jeeves and Wooster episodes and stuff. Like he adapted P.G. Wodehouse. How did he also write Red Sonja?
Castle Berkebane? Lord Breitag?
Oh my god.
Oh my. Oh.
Prince Tern and Falcon? Oh my god, Falcon was played by Beast Rabin.
I already said that.
He did.
I was asleep.
The
movie is so terrible it's destroyed my short-term memory.
And in answer to the whole Red Sonja thing, she was a character created by Howard in one of his historical fantasy stories, like one of his, you know, fighting Steve Costigan or something stories, one of his more realistic stories. The name was just cribbed by Roy Thomas when he created the character for the 70s Marvel comics.
Hmm. Yeah, man, in the comics, she was pretty badass.
Well, I mean, the movie is essentially an adaptation of the comics. And the other reason, of course, the reason why Arnold appears as Kalidor, not Conan, is because it was a different studio that had the rights to Red Sonja than Conan, and they couldn't come to an arrangement. I think Dino De Laurentiis...
See, I didn't know that. I was kind of assuming that it was, you know, a continuation of the same sketchy Italian producers or something. And
yeah, no, it was a different
studio.
And they
just had a whole bunch of costumes. And
no, it was still the De Laurentiis company, but... this was distributed by MGM, whereas I believe Conan is Universal.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And basically what it was is when the screenplay and stuff was written, it was Conan. Excuse me.
You're allergic to it.
Yeah, I'm allergic to the shittiness of Red Sonja. It's such an awful movie. The action is horrible. The acting is horrible. The sets are horrible, except for that throne.
This movie makes my gooch burn.
This movie
he goes out like a punk.
Yeah. Oh, it's just, oh, I don't even want to talk about this movie anymore. It's giving me a headache.
It's the only movie that Dino De Laurentiis is more embarrassed about than King Kong, I think.
We talking about the Jeff
That's
Bridges
a lie.
King
He's
Kong?
Made some really bad movies.
Yeah, I think we're talking about the 70s King Kong there, John.
Dino De Laurentiis isn't that old.
No, I was wondering if we're talking about that or King Kong Lives.
Oh.
Because I think he had his fingers in that, too.
Oh, yeah, actually, maybe he did.
Ugh. Wasn't the 70s King Kong kind of a hit?
It probably was, actually, just, you know, in spite of everything.
All right, King Kong Lives his plot. I'm sorry, because this has nothing to do with Fleischer. I just have to bring this up. King Kong, after being shot down from the World Trade Center, is kept alive in a coma for about 10 years at the Atlantic Institute.
Wow.
I need to find
an
this movie.
To the heroes of 9/11.
Huh? America's biggest hero is back, and he's not happy. All right, back to Dick Fleischer.
All right. Are we done with Red Sonja?
I'm done with Red Sonja, unless you guys have anything else you want to add.
No.
No.
All right, I'm going to go on to my ugly. And it's probably going to irritate some people because it's actually a movie that's held in fairly high regard. Ooh. But I hated it. Fantastic Voyage. I hated this movie. I hated everything about it. Because, you know, I can go with a stupid, unscientific sci-fi movie if that's all it's trying to be. But if you spend the entire movie pointing out all the sciencey stuff, and you start your movie with a dedication to the experts that helped you in getting everything so accurate, and then you completely fuck up every aspect of every scientific thing in your movie, and completely ignore like major plot problems that a five-year-old could spot, it is going to bug me. I mean, I'm going to spoil the movie somewhat. This is a movie where they shrink a team of four people, I think, down into a syringe, including like 8 gallons of saline fluid, which we are, you know, we watched the soul-crushingly laborious process of everything being shrunk down, because nothing is more exciting than people slowly pushing a cart into a room and then wheeling the cart out equally slowly. At the end of the movie, when the people are brought back out, they don't bring out any of the saline solution, which is going to automatically return to full size after an hour. And I don't know why anyone would forget after we were spent so much time looking at how this process happened and everyone kept reminding us everything we put in there is going to grow back to regular size. The guy they injected the people into should be a hollowed out canoe. Get that guy into trouble in Little China and then blow up like that guy in Monty Python. And
don't they leave Donald Pleasance in there?
He apparently dissolves. Donald Pleasance, you know that Donald Pleasance is going to be the bad guy because he's kind of unimpressed by Arthur Kennedy's sort of pseudo-profound comments about the glory of God's amazing design and how this is all going to happen. And I'm okay with that. It was a different time. I don't mind. You know, they're... It's Cold War era, you know, they're afraid of the godless Russians and whatnot, but it's just kind of like sloppy characterization. And then, you know, they run out of air, so they go to the lung to just get some air, which is just like big wind. Even though, like, they're looking at like molecules of other stuff, which are like the size of grapefruits, but for some reason they can breathe unminiaturized air. They get dissolved by these, like, or they get attacked by antibodies, which basically look like, I don't know, like boogers that they've thrown all over Raquel Welch, and then the male cast members sort of desperately grope at her, trying to get the stuff off, and it's just like, none of it's consistent. It's completely inconsistent. The premise of the movie is like, they didn't care about any of the details of their premise. And it's constantly in your face throughout the movie. And the movie is just slow and dull. And the special effects aren't as amazing as those in 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. It's like, you can tell they have like a big sheet and they've spray painted some like cell lines on it. Waves in the background.
It doesn't have that crazy Walt Disney money behind it.
It's just, oh.
Also, you know what it does have?
Wanted a drink for the entire thing.
It does have a Hot as Rocks Raquel Welch show.
Yeah, but you know what? There are better movies to go to if that's what you want.
Yeah, this is also true.
And it stars Steven Charisma Bypass Boyd. I don't know why this guy was ever a star. He was okay with Fall of the Roman Empire, which is a movie I really like. I hate it, but...
I wonder if Isaac Asimov ever got mad when people used to think he wrote the book that inspired the movie?
The thing, Isaac Asimov, you know, he pointed out that he did the novelization of, and he pointed,
which they released like 6 months before the movie.
And he tried to sort of solve some of the problems that he saw in the premise. But even the way he solves them, if that were the case, you raise some other problems. Like he said, you know, oh, there was a miniaturization field. So when things come into the field, they miniaturize, but that doesn't really work because then they've got antibodies that are full size and they're like dissolving things. It's just the whole thing is just a mess and it wasn't well thought out.
No. And, some of the effects were really bad too.
Yeah. I mean, some of them are quite good. A lot of them are not. It was, it's got all the like pomp and dullness of a major Hollywood production from the mid 60s. None of the good that might come along with that.
It's bad. It really is. It's not a good movie. It's a pretty terrible movie. It's not quite Red Sonja terrible, but it's pretty terrible.
The thing with Red Sonja is I had a bit of that kind of like, at least it's a sword and sorcery movie.
Yeah, yeah.
Helping it along, and this I had none of that.
It doesn't completely stab you in the logic.
And this one stabbed me with logic. All right. Well, I guess now we should probably talk about some final thoughts because I want to stop thinking about Fantastic Voyage. And I'm just afraid that if I say anything more about it, I'm just going to earn even more pain from people who disagree with me. So, final thoughts on Richard Fleischer, John.
I don't know. I'm still hung up on the whole, you know, once the 80s started, Fleischer just could not catch a break.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this was a guy who created some, you know, well-regarded, pretty epic films back in the golden years of Hollywood. And he goes out on a promotional film with about Glad garbage bags.
It's sad. I mean, a lot of those studio guys, it seems that's kind of what happened. You know?
I like Fleischer. I like as a creative force, I think he's a pretty solid director. Technically, he's really skilled, but right from Word One, right from his early days with RKO, right up to his end, I got to say the guy definitely struck me as more of a hired gun than anything. You know, like I don't think he did a whole lot of projects that he really in his heart of hearts believed in. And I won't say, you know, phoned it in as such. More so, he was, you know, he was a technical guy. He was a hired gun. He was, you know, like with Tora Tora Tora, he was brought in because the studio needed someone reliable to get the shots done. You know, like he basically came in, picked up the pieces, and assembled them into a finished movie. And sometimes it worked better than others, you know?
I think it was a bit of a family business thing.
Yeah.
Max Fleischer was, you know, a studio owner, an innovator, and he grew up in that kind of atmosphere. He was obviously a talented guy. But, yeah, he never had that story sort of coming from inside himself that he really wanted to tell, I think. And, you know, an amazingly technically proficient guy.
Yeah, I think he was, you know, gifted enough with a camera to hopefully have done Dad proud.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, you know, despite us getting into the bad and ugly of his career, Fleischer's Good was astonishingly good.
Yeah.
Right? You don't believe me, go pick up a copy of Narrow Margin.
I mean, yeah, Armored Car Robbery, Narrow Margin, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, Vikings.
Bodyguard.
If you haven't seen it, pretty darn good. Bodyguard.
He's done a lot of great stuff. He's done a lot of, like, you know, it's not fair to say that he's a schlock director, even though most of what he'd done out of the 80s was schlock.
He was very good. And, you know, I'd say he's, you know, he's a step above, well, a couple of steps above a really gifted second unit director in the sense that personal vision, you know, he can initiate a project and control a project and make some pretty pictures, but yeah. He's not Orson Welles.
He's not Orson Welles.
Regardless of what you think of Orson Welles represents a certain kind of filmmaker, and Fleischer is not that.
Well, he's definitely not, you know, like, say, Billy Wilder.
No, that's an even better example.
Yeah.
You know Billy Wilder. But, yeah, everybody go watch Soylent Green.
And the Vikings.
Yeah. And Narrow Margin.
Oh, for God's sakes, watch Narrow Margin. Just don't make the mistake and pick up the Peter Himes one.
Yeah.
It's not terrible, but it's not glorious either.
Speaking of which, who are we doing next week?
Peter Himes.
Good movie by accident.
Empty streets, dark sets, and pretty solid camera work.
He does his own lighting. And he holds the light.
He does his own lighting. He turns the switch off.
There's a reason it's so dark. All right.
I guess there's only one thing left to say.
Doesn't Gabe normally say it?
Yeah, he's not here. Someone else has got to say it.
I can't say it.
See you next Wednesday.
Hey!